Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Ir HaKedesh, is daf Yud Gimel. And we are holding right at the Halakha Mishnah. And I think before we begin, it might be worthwhile reviewing some of the complexities where we're up to, because we have a lot of things that are hanging here. So we have a lot of issues that have not been any kind of final determination. There are many questions about the nature of the betula that we're talking about. And one of the most important ones, of course, was what is the din of a mukat eitz? So that was one question that we had before, and it was a big machlokas between Rebbe Meir and the Rabbanan. Do we view a mukat eitz as basically being exactly the same as a bogeret, a normal girl who grows up? By the time she's already 12 and a half, she doesn't really have any meaningful betulim. And especially if she's a gymnast or a bike rider or whatever. So that's not the type of thing that we're going to believe. Somebody's going to say, I really thought that she was a betula. She is a betula, you know. That's considered to be a betula. Is a mukat eitz, however, the same as a bogeret? That's the question. So this we saw was a machlokas. According to Rabbi Meir, it's exactly the same. I mean, this is standard. So if somebody loses their betulim due to mukat eitz, same thing as growing up. It's all part of growing up, so to speak, according to Rabbi Meir. According to the Rabbanan, she's considered to be the same as a be'ula. Now, on the back of that machlokas, we also had the other question, which was, what if he didn't know that she was a non-betula, literally? What if he didn't know? Now, Rami Bar Chama said before that this whole machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is only what kind of ketuvah he should write when he knows that she's a mukat eitz. But if he didn't even know she's a mukat eitz, so then she wouldn't get anything. Not according to Rabbi Meir and not according to Chachamim. Well, why didn't you tell me that you're not a betula? I thought that you were a betula. And that would mean that it was considered to be a mekach ta'ut. So that's a different issue. So we have three questions. Question, is it a full ketubah? Is it a mana ketubah, like the Rabbanan? And might it be zero ketubah if he can claim I should have been told, which is only true according to Rami Bar Chama? That was one question that we had. Now, another question that we had was also the Reb Sheshes issue before, where we wanted to know, what if, in fact, she really was a bu'ula, and she was a bu'ula from before that he ever had been ma'aris her? So he was machnis becheskat betula. She turns out to be a bu'ula. What is the din over there? So according to Reb Chiya Bar Ovin, remember, he was medayik before and said, well, this means that she still gets a mana. And then we had the question, so how do you understand the Mishnah, yesterday's Mishnah, that said, Vaya mikrim mikach ta'ut. Doesn't a mekach ta'ut mean you get nothing? And the only way that we could work out that Mishnah, according to this approach of Reb Chiya Bar Ovin, is that when it says that, it means it's a mekach ta'ut that I wrote you a ketuvah of mataim. And really, you only deserve a ketuvah of mana. Now, Rav objected to that yesterday. And he said, we don't use the language mekach ta'ut to mean half of a ta'ut or on the amount. But fine, these are the standing machlokases. Is there any ketuvah for a bu'ula where the husband never knew? Is there any ketuvah for a mukat eitz where he didn't know? If there is a ketuvah, is it a ketuvah of matayim or is it a ketuvah of me'ah? Those are the questions of the amounts. Now, we also had the question of belief, because where there was an argument, as we said before, about whether she was a betula or not, so there we had our deal that the rabbanu were the ones who made the din of the ketuvah, and the morning after, the night before, they are ready to believe the Baal. Why? Because they don't think that anybody requires the, what it boils down to, this is not the way the Gemara puts it, but they don't believe that anybody requires the protection of a ketuvah to make it difficult to divorce her the morning after, the night before. Why? Because the very fact that the man has just wasted $20,000 or $200,000, whatever it is, on a wedding, means that there's no way he's going to get up the next morning and start claiming that she was a bula. I mean, this is it's a horrific situation. Obviously, it's embarrassing. The whole thing is crazy. So nobody would do that. So therefore, there never was really a takana of a ketuvah in the first place to cover a situation like that. So what we say is, heim tiknu veheim haminu. They were the one who mitakein this protection, and they were the one who believed a husband. In this particular case, in singular case, where there was a very powerful mini'ah, there was a prevention against going, I'm drinking and digging, turn your mic off. And I'm telling you, he's what's the word? Okay, so there we had the din of belief of the husband. What about, though, if we have an argument about the explanation, not whether she was a betula, but why she's not a betula? So then, now we could have numerous situations over there. I mean, on the one hand, of course, she may not be a betula because she slept with somebody after she was already in Arusa, in which case, obviously, not only would she not have a ketuvah, she blew her marriage because they're not allowed to remain married. So that could be a problem, and that was one of the original points of his coming to Beit Din, to, well, let's find out, because maybe some people will come forward and know, is she asura to me? That was all part of the original takana of why we want her to get married and then be able to come to Beis Din the next day before cooling off, because there may actually be Yisurin involved. So we had that question. And then yesterday we started on the argumentations about, did I sleep with somebody? Was I raped? Or was I sleeping with somebody because I wanted to? Was it before we were engaged? Was it after we were engaged? Is the guy a Kohen? Do we remember all of these issues? Do we have a Sfeik Sfeika? In which case there wouldn't be an Isser. If he's a Kohen, we only have one Suffolk. In the event that she was married before she was 3 years old, we also only have one Suffolk, and so on and so forth. There are a heck of a lot of elements that need to be taken into consideration here. And almost every case is going to involve these types of questions, including her claim that I never slept with anybody. I was only a mukaseitz. What makes you think I ever slept with anybody? And then, of course, we would have the sub-questions. In that event, would she be entitled to a ketuvah of Matayim, like Rebbe Meir? Would she be entitled to a ketuvah of Mana, like the Rabbanan? Would she be entitled to zero because she never told the guy? And Rami Bar Chama claims that even Rabbi Meir would be murdered, that she doesn't get anything if she didn't tell the guy, and that it's a mekachtos. I mean, so as you can see, you're not going to get a simple answer to any of these questions. And therefore, each one of these mishnayos needs to be understood in the context of all of the various shitas that we had before, including even how we understand the words Mikhi mekach ta'ut. Is it a complete mekach ta'ut, or is it a mekach ta'ut from the amount? Furthermore, we had the other question of the issue of Bari Veshema, which we raised yesterday, that the machlokas on the one hand with Rabbi Gamliel, we're going to have a series of issues in which one party claims, I know 100% what happened. And in this case, of course, the girl knows what happened. The boy doesn't know what happened. But she's saying, well, I can tell you what happened. And he says, well, how do I know I can trust you about what happened? Meaning that he is coming back with a Shema. Maybe it was different. Maybe it wasn't what you're claiming, right? So we have numerous cases, and we're going to see the difference between them. We're going to have numerous cases, one Mishnah after another, including additional cases in the Braitot, where we have elements of Bari Veshema, and we have a machlokas as to whether that is sufficient to be motzi momon from somebody and get him to pay the ketuvah, or in a case where it was a matter which we raised yesterday as a machlokas amaroyim, if somebody says, you owe me money, and the guy says, well, maybe I do, I don't remember, whether you have to pay because you're saying maybe I do, or whether we still say a motzi bechaver olav araya. So complicated the machlokas amoraim with the cases of the machlokas of the Tanaim over here. On the one hand, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Gamliel, who seem to be saying that we will believe the Bori against the Shema, and Rabbi Yoshua, who said yesterday, we will not believe the Bori against the Shema. And in fact, he seems to say we assume the worst in all of these cases, which is also strange. Why would we assume the worst? And what we came out with yesterday is that there's an interesting difference between a straight-out Bori v'Shema question versus a Bori v'Shema question where the Bori is supported by an additional Taina. So if the Bori is supported by the fact that there was a Migul as well, which argues for belief in the Bori, or, as we'll see today, we didn't discuss yesterday at any length, but as we'll see today, we also need to take into consideration the Chazaka, that is to say the woman has a Cheskes Kashrus. So we have that question to take into consideration as well. And therefore, we have a pretty complicated situation in all of these cases. Let us try to get through the additional Mishnayos today and have our second case of the Bori v'Shema problem. So we had yesterday, we had a Bori v'Shema case, and that was the first of a series of Mishnayos of Bori v'Shemas. And over there, the Bori v'Shema was about the question of when exactly the problem had taken place. So she claims that she was raped yesterday. She claimed that she was raped after the Erusin took place, in which case it's his problem because, as the Lashon of the Mishnah uses it, Nistachfcha Sadecha. And he says, well, maybe not. Maybe this happened beforehand, in which case you were already a Ba'ula at the time, and it's a Mekach Ta'ut. Now remember that even what the difference is between the two Tainas is not clear, because Mekach Ta'ut may mean you get nothing, or Mekach Ta'ut may mean you get a Mana, depending on which approach we take, which we'll review again today, and which I just reviewed. So over there we had our first Bori v'Shema. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer says, well, she's Nemenet, and Rabbi Yeshua says, no, she's not Nemenet. Now, in that case, she does have a migo, because instead of saying she was raped, she could have said that she was a mukat eitz, and that would have removed any problems about her suitability for kohen, and that would have been a better kind of taina, right? So we had a migo that was supportive of a bori, and what we saw in that case is that where there is a bori against a shema that's supported by a migo, we will go with the Bori, even though it's not a standard Migo, because it doesn't give her more Ne'amanut, and even though it's a Migo Lahotzi, because she's collecting money on it, and we don't usually go with a Migo Lahotzi, but the combination of a Bori against a Shema with a Migo is enough to be Motzi, even though it's just a better Taina psychologically, and not necessarily a better Taina legally. That was the Chiddush in yesterday's Mishnah. Now, today we want to talk about a further question of Bori v'Shema and a further machlokas between Rebbe Gamliel and Rebbe Eliezer. And of course, we're going to have to analyze why is it further. What is the additional chiddush of this Mishnah above yesterday's Mishnah? So let's take a look at the Mishnah now, keeping all of these elements in mind so that we don't jump to any conclusions. He omeret mukat eitz ani, v'hu omer lo ke'ela drusat ishat. So now we've got the question about what is my status, gufa, not when, but what. What happened? So he's saying, look, all I know is that you don't have any betulim. She says, well, yeah, I had a bike accident. I fell right on that boy's bike I was driving. Never should have driven a boy's bike. That's why they designed girls' bikes differently, you'll notice. Exactly to avoid the mukas eitz problem. Women's bikes are designed in such a way that, A, they don't have to spread their legs when getting on the bike, and B, that in the event that they fall off the bike onto that metal bar, which is quite painful for boys too, but still doesn't have these permanent results, hopefully. So the bike is designed in such a way, even though it's a weaker bike because of it, to avoid the mukas eitz. So this is, obviously a well-recognized issue. So in that case, she claims, I was just a mukas eitz. And he says, well, why should I believe that? All I know is that I thought that you were a betula. And as far as I'm concerned, you slept with somebody. So Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer say, in this case as well, she's an emenet. Rabbi Yoshua says the same thing he said yesterday. Why should we believe her? After all, the world is supported by truth, right? And are we saying that our world is supported by the truth of her mouth? Lo mi pianu chayin. I ain't living off of what she claims is reality. We have to assume that harezu b'cheskas drusat ish. Until she can prove it. Okay, so basically it's the same issue. The question over here is obviously we don't have a migu. There's no better taina that she could have brought than the one that she's saying, because there's no advantage. I mean, what would she say? She's saying the migu ish, she should have said I was a drusas ish after we already got engaged. It wouldn't have made any difference. That's not a better taina. It's the same idea of a mukas eight. But remember that in this case, the Taina of the Bori is supported by the Chazaka that she certainly was initially a Betula, and she was kosher, and she had a Cheskas Kashrus, and therefore we still have a support for the fact that she should be okay. So let's look at the Mishnah, because obviously there are many different issues that have to be taken into consideration for us to understand. So what exactly was the suit about? In other words, what was he claiming in terms of money? Forget about what happened. What was he claiming he owes her, and what was she claiming he owes her? So let's try to understand that. So to Anatayu Bemai, what was the argument about? So Rabbi Yochanan says, well, she claims a full ktuva of Matayim, and he claims that he only owes her money. Whereas Rabbi Elazar says, no. She claims that she's owed a mana, and he claims, I don't owe you anything. Now, let's understand what this involves based on the previous machlokas that we had, which was the machlokas Rabbi Meir and the Rabbanan about how much does a mukas eitz get? Does a mukas eitz, is she just viewed, as Rabbi Meir claims, is she just viewed as a simple bogeret? So she grew up, you know, they grew up riding a bike and grew up because just plain years is basically normal, and therefore Rabbi Meir says Matayim. And that's the question. But then, of course, we have that additional question, which is, well, if he says, but I didn't know about it, you never told me that you are a Mukat Eitz. So then remember that we had the question of even a mukas eitz, according to Rami Bar Choma, the machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, Rami Bar Choma said is only if he knew how much does he write. But if he didn't know, he has a right to say, how come you never told me? And therefore, I don't owe you anything. So now this is going to be part of, obviously, of the way that we're thinking about it right now, in what exactly is the machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan, who claims that we're arguing about 200, which she claims, and 100, which he's ready to pay, and Rebbe Lezer claims, who says that she claims only 100, and he says zero. So let's explain it now, says the Gemara. Rabbi Yochanan says, the machlokas over here, no, I shouldn't say the machlokas, the suit over here is between she who insists on 200, and he must obviously hold that the Tana of this Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir says that you pay 200, and therefore we're also taking into consideration that it doesn't matter whether bein hi kirba, bein lo hi kirba. So, I mean, he obviously did not know, and she's not arguing about that. She never says over here, well, you knew I was mukat eitz. So if what we're saying is that Libet Rabbi Meir, by her claiming that she was a mukas eitz, she is saying, I get 200. And when he says, no, you don't, because I think maybe somebody slept with you, and therefore you only get 100. Now, that itself is also a question that we had before. If, in fact, someone had slept with her, does she get nothing, like the previous Mishnah implied, haya mikhi mekach ta'ut, or does she get 100, and mekach ta'ut only means you don't get the full 200? So that means that Rabbi Yochanan is making two assumptions over here. He's making one assumption that it's going like Rabbi Meir. I should say three assumptions. It's going like Rabbi Meir, and that a mukas eitz gets 200. Furthermore, he's making another very important assumption, which is that if it's going like Rabbi Meir, then it doesn't matter whether you knew about it or you didn't know about it. It's still 200, in which case he's making another assumption that the halacha is not like Rami Bar Chama, who claimed before that everyone, even Rabbi Meir, agrees that if you didn't know about it, you don't have to pay. Not true. You'd have to pay. So she's claiming, you didn't know, but I was a mukaseitz, give me my 200. That's the second assumption. Rabbi Meir, anti-Rami Bar Chama. And furthermore, it's also like Rabbi Chiya Bar Ovin, who said before that when the Mishnah said, Mikhi mekach ta'ut, because someone had you before me, that means mekach ta'ut only vis-a-vis not paying you 200. It doesn't mean that it's a mekach ta'ut and you get nothing and our marriage is null and void. Okay? So we've reviewed now the three assumptions that Rabbi Yochanan is making with his understanding of the Mishnah. She wants 200. He wants to pay 100. Rabbi Lezer, on the other hand, obviously, he says, well, why should we assume that our Mishnah is Rabbi Meir? The Mishnah is obviously going like the Rove, which is the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan said that when she admits that she's a Mukat Eitz, so then she only gets 100. And when he says, well, maybe you were a bula by a human, then the question is, I don't have to pay you at all. So he's going according to the understanding in the Mishnah before, that hayamikhi mekach ta'ut, that I owe you nothing. So in other words, Rabbi Lezer is arguing with Rabbi Yochanan on two separate issues. One is the Mishnah is not Rabbi Meir and that a mukaseitz only gets 100. And the other is, in the event that she was a ba'ula, she gets nothing. Okay, so there, let's take a look and understand how the Gemara points this out. And it goes through why it is that Rabbi Yochanan is arguing in how he understands it with Rabbi Lezer. Yes, Gershi.
Sorry, Rabbi, just to get this straight, Rabbi Lezer doesn't hold with Baruch Hashem. If he says that it's a Maneva Klu. Because if her, she says that it's
No. We're arguing the Machlokas is not what she gets. The Machlokas is what she wants and what he wants. As to whether we believe them, that's in the Mishnah, Machlokas, between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua. We're only discussing now what are they arguing about, not who's believed. This is irrelevant to the Baruch Hashem issue, completely. It's going to keep it all separate. First, let's think about what the case is. What's the court case over? Then we'll talk about who do we paskin like. Okay, so now I understand Rabbi Lezer's position. Obviously, nobody in his right mind would want to say that a Mishnah is only going according to Rabbi Meir if the Rabbanan argue. And the fact is that a Mukas Eitz really is only entitled to a Ksuva of Mea. Okay, so why should we say that they're arguing about whether she gets the 200? Kamuki like Rabbanan. He says the Tana is probably the Rabbanan who hold Mea. But Rabbi Yochanan, why was he insistent that no, we can't learn it that way. It has to be that it's going like Rabbi Meir. Why? Why? It's very simple. It's clear that Rabbi Yochanan begins with one assumption, and that assumption is that if somebody marries a woman believing that she is a betula, and it turns out that she actually was a bu'ula, that she still gets a ksuva of 100, which, of course, we said before, that is a machlokas. It's exactly what the machlokas was before. And that was Rabbi Chiya Bar Ovin. Remember Rabbi Chiya Bar Ovin on Daf Yud Aleph? He claimed that we see from the Brisa that if there was an argument about whether she was a ba'ula or not, even if she was a ba'ula, she does get a ksuva of a mana. Well, Rabbi Yochanan holds that way. So he has no choice but to say that she is claiming two. Because if he's ready to pay one, and she was claiming a mukas eitz, and it's going according to Rabbanan, then she's claiming the same thing he's claiming. What do I care what happened? Nobody's going to go to court over what happened. They're going to go to court about how much they have to pay. So he's ready to pay one, and she's only claiming one, and just for different reasons, then the Mishnah is a joke. So if you take off from the basic assumption that a woman who was a Ba'ula is still entitled to one, and the Baal cannot claim that I was fooled and I give you nothing, then you have no choice. The Mishnah can only be going like Rabbi Meir, right? So that makes perfectly good sense once you have that approach. There's nothing else to say. So therefore, since he holds that concept of Cheskat Betula v'Nimtzeit Be'ula, she would still have a Ksuva of Amana. So then, Hocha, what are they arguing about? He's saying Amana, she's saying Amana. So Ma'ika ben Taina de Dei, the Taina de Da. There's no difference between her demands and his willingness to pay. So it must be that she's claiming 200, in which case the Tana must be going like Rabbi Meir, and when she says Mukatetzani, she is saying only something that makes sense. I'll leave it to Rabbi Meir. Therefore, it says Rabbi Yochanan. Obviously, the mission is going like Rabbi Meir. Okay, now this makes a tremendous difference in why we would have two Mishnayos. Yesterday we had a question about when the event took place. Today we have a question about what event took place. Was it a Mukas Eitz or was it an actual act of Bia? Now, it's basically, as far as the main point of the Mishnah is concerned, namely, that there's a machlokes about whether we say Bori Veshema, that Bori is sufficient to be Motzi. Okay, why do I need two Mishnayos? I mean, that's the main focus over here. Give me one case. You're trying to bring out what the din is about Bori Veshema. Tell me, what is added by two cases? Now, according to Rabbi Elazar, I understand that there's an extremely important need for both of these Mishnayos, because without both of them, I end up without crucial information that's nogeya the general dinim of Ksuvas, as opposed to just the issue of Bori Veshema. Because Bishlam, according to Rabbi Lazar, who says that if she really was a Bula, then she gets nothing, and that's what the Chosson is claiming over here, I don't owe you a dime, and she's only arguing for a mana. So then I understand now why I need to hear two completely different Mishnayos about when, was it before or after the Urusin, which was yesterday's Mishnah, and today's Mishnah about whether she is a Mukas Eitz or whether she's a Bula. Because Chada is Lafuki min Romi Bar Chama. Look, our Mishnah is to tell us that Romi Bar Chama, who claimed before that both Rabbi Meir and the Rabbanan agree that if the Chosson didn't know that she was a Mukas Eitz, she gets no Ksuva. This Mishnah whacks that out of the ballpark. Forget it. Go by. Because over here, she is claiming something by saying she was a Mukas Eitz, right? So obviously, I need to have this Mishnah to make sure that I don't make that mistake, because I don't want to think like Rami Bar Chama. And the halacha is, in fact, that there's still a standing machlokas about whether you get 200 or 100, but nobody says you don't get anything if you're a Mukas Eitz, because then how do we make sense of a Mishnah where she's coming along and saying, well, you didn't know, but I was a Mukas Eitz. Thank you very much. I won't give you any money. That's exactly what I said. Okay, so therefore, I need that Mishnah to address that that's our Mishnah, in other words, to address that issue of Rami Bar Chama. And then I need yesterday's Mishnah to tell me that Reb Chiya Bar Avin Omer of Sheshes, who claimed that if she was a Bu'ula before, Reb Chiya Bar Avin, remember, said that she still gets a mana. But this Mishnah, the Mishnah that we had yesterday, is coming to tell me that actually, V'haya mikhi mekach ta'ut, you get nothing. That was the simple meaning of the Mishnah. So the fact that we have two cases is very clear, because they're dealing with the sub-machlokasin that had not been addressed by a Mishnah previously. One is our Mishnah. One is, if you don't know about a Mukates, can you claim Mekach Ta'ut? And the other one was, if you don't know that she was a Bu'ula, is it a complete Mekach Ta'ut? Or do you get, still, do you have to give her a mana, which is Reb Chiya Bar Avin, or really Reb Sheshes, that we had earlier. But according to Rabbi Yochanan, you're really not adding anything, because according to Rabbi Yochanan, our Mishnah that says that you can get a mana, That means that when it said Vayamikhi Mekach Ta'ut in yesterday's Mishnah, it doesn't mean to tell me that Rabbi Chiya Bar Avin is wrong. It's just saying that you're only entitled to a mona and you're not entitled to matayim. And the fact that I wrote you a ksuva of matayim, that was a mekach ta'ut, right? So that's how he understood the previous mission. Because if he holds like Rabbi Chiya Bar Avin Amar Reb Sheshes, he has no choice. He's got to read that mission that way. So then that means we don't really know anything from that Mishnah that we don't know from this Mishnah. This Mishnah, I understand, I need to know. Because this Mishnah tells me the whole story. It tells me that when he claims you are a bula, he's still ready to pay her 100. And when she claims that she's a mukas 8, she wants 200. And that gives me all of the data. If he says, I admit I owe you 100, so then that means that he is telling us that Locha is like Rabbi Chiya Bar Avin. And there is no taina mekachtos. If she claims 200, it means that we also don't agree with Romi Bar Chama, who says that everybody would admit that you don't pay money if you didn't know that she had a bike accident, right? So what was the point of having both Mishnayos? I don't understand. Leave out that old first Mishnah. After all, what's left? To tell me the machlokas about Bari Vashema. Okay, great. So tell me the machlokas of Bari Vashema. You did that in this Mishnah. So you added absolutely nothing in the previous Mishnah. Bori Vashema, this Mishnah. Rumi Bar Chama, this Mishnah. Rav Chiya Bar Avin Amar Reb Sheshes, this Mishnah. So what in the world was the whole Daf Yomi yesterday about? According to Rabbi Yochanan, we could have taken off an Amud from Shas. How do you explain that? Answers the Gemara, no. Because I still need to tell you a Chiddush about Bori Vashema, you see. What's the Kiddush? Very simple. One of the Mishnayos teaches me how far Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer are ready to go about Bori Vashema. And one is to tell you how far Rabbi Yoshua is willing to go to reject Bori Vashema. And let me explain to you. The first Mishnah had a Bori Vashema that was supported with a Miga. Because what she should have said is that I was a Mukat Eitz. And instead she says, I was raped, which postles her to a Kohen. I mean, if she wants to say something that is far more appropriate and less embarrassing, I mean, what woman says that I was raped when she could say I had a bike accident? I mean, it's crazy. So she must be telling the truth. Now, that's not really a valid taina, as we say, because you can't be motzi momon on the basis of that kind of argument. And furthermore, it does not help her in terms of whether she's believed for the amount of money. But still, it's psychologically a better taina, and it supports the bori. So that's coming to tell me, that first Mishnah, is even so, Rabbi Yeshua says, look, I don't care about any of this garbage. The halacha is that hamotzi michavero olav haraya. Don't bring me psychology as a raya for somebody else to pay money. And don't bring me the fact that he says, I don't know. Saying you don't know doesn't put you in the chair to pay, does it? That's your problem. You want to worry about maybe you owe money and you don't want to go to Olam Haba owing a guy money, so pay him. But don't come to court and say that the guy's got to pay you. It's a chassidus that he should pay you if he believes you. Fine. That I need to know. And even in the case where there is an ego. So therefore, it's lo diach hakocho de Rabbi Yoshua. Even though I have an ego, we still don't believe her with the taina of Bori. But the next Mishnah, today's Mishnah that we just had, is to tell us that Rabbi Gamliel is ready to go all the way with the Bori Vashema, even though there is no Migu. What's the Migu in this case? I mean, she's getting 200 with the taina that she's claiming. What better taina does she have? However, there is a chazaka, of course, because the chazaka is that she had that cheskes kashrus before. So, afagav de lekel amim armigo, it's good enough just to have a chazaka, and we will still say, Bori Vashema, Bori Odif, in this case. Okay, now, we have a lot more to discuss in terms of Bori Vashema. Because we've been discussing now monetary issues. We discussed yesterday whether the monetary issues are ipso facto descriptive of the situation in terms of Isser Veheter to a Kohen or to her husband. We saw that was about Machlokas Rishonim. Today, we want to discuss the question of Bori Vashema, Binogea Yichus itself, and not talking at all about implications for her current marriage. We're talking in these cases where she wasn't even married. Okay, so we've got two more cases in this Mishnah, which is about to be introduced by our Kapitan, who is our intrepid Kapitan. No matter how many difficult Mishnayos we have, he always leads the way, and there he is, always putting himself down with a shake of the head. Don't trust me, but I can tell you about the... So, today we have a question like this. You see a girl, she's not even married. You see a girl talking with somebody. And now, obviously, talking with somebody is no reason for a court to get involved and ask, all right, who is that guy? None of your damn business. That can't be the case. So we're going to try to understand what talking means. I mean, it's obviously some kind of euphemism, but how big of a euphemism is it? So we see her talking to somebody, and we say, so what's this guy all about? And she says, oh, he's a great guy. Ish ploni v'kohenu. He's got perfect yichus. So Rabbi Gamliel for Rabbi Eliezer Omrim, fine. What, we believe her, and therefore her chazaka until this time has been that she was kosher to marry a Kohen, and she remains kosher to marry a Kohen. Rabbi Yoshua says, get out of here. Lo mi pianu chayin. We're not going to live in a world supported by this level of truth, are we? Ela harezo becheskat bu'ulal natina lamamzer, which seems awfully crazy. I mean, why in the first of all we saw was that she was talking to somebody, and now we're saying that she was sleeping with a guy who is a mamzer and he's usher to get married. Like, I mean, like, how did we go that far? That we'll all have to see until she can prove what she says. The second case is she obviously went a bit further than talking because she's pregnant. Well, that doesn't happen through talking unless you're a Christian. So haitamu uberet va'amrula mati voshel uberzu. So they ask her, okay, so can you tell us, like, what type of child this is, meaning who is the father? Oh, meish ploni v'koino. She gives the name. He's a famous Kohen. He's kosher 100%, wonderful yichus. Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, Omrim, ne'emenet. Now, we have to ask the Rebbe whether he would marry the daughter that she gives birth to because of this gewaldike yichus that she has, or whether the Rebbe might have certain hesitations about accepting her yichus, because maybe subconsciously he holds like Rabbi Yoshua, who says, lo mi pianu chayin, why should we live in a world based of her belief? Actually, we'd have to assume the worst. Harezu b'cheskas mu'beret l'natin v'lamamzer ad shetavi raya lidvareha, until she can prove it. Okay, so now, right away it strikes you that there are two ways of understanding the Mishnah. Way number one is that the first case really does mean we don't have any clear-cut indication that they've been sleeping together. Because all we know is that they've been alone. So that's what we mean, they've been talking together. And sometimes talk goes too far. And that would be the two cases. The second case where she's pregnant means that we know that they went too far. And the first case is that we don't know. And that would be why the Mishnah mentions two cases. The other way of understanding the Mishnah is that the difference is, in both cases, we know that they actually slept together. And the reason that we introduce the second case is because the issue over there is what's the status of the child, not what is the status of the mother. And the very important difference would be, obviously, that the child does not have a cheskas kashrus. Because if the father was someone that would be a mamzer or a natin, why would we say that she isn't a mamzeret? There was no chazaka, but when it comes to the mother, the issue is not what is the mother's yichus. The issue is, did the mother have the type of relation that would aser her on a kohen? Now, that has nothing to do with the status of the child. So therefore, the Mishnah adds up very beautifully. Case number one is, we want to know what is your status, madam. Who is this guy that you've been hanging around with, and we assume the worst? And the second case is, all right, let's not even discuss it. Who's the father? And therefore, we want to know what the status of the child is, right? So that adds up right away. You see, there's basis for two completely different ways. And therefore, our first question is, what do we mean when the Mishnah says we see her speaking? What does speaking mean? So Ze'iri says, well, look, the second case in the Mishnah is the case where she's pregnant, and therefore she obviously slept with him. The first case must mean that she was alone with him, and we suspect that they had slept together. Rav Asi says, no, when it says speaking, it means actual intercourse. Now, I understand, according to Ze'iri, because, I mean, it says talking. It doesn't say sleeping together. I mean, so if it says midaberet, so then that must mean midaberet in a way that makes us suspect that they're lovers. But according to Rav Asi, I mean, if you want to say we see her sleeping with somebody, why does it say we see her talking to somebody? Well, I mean, that could just be a lishna malia. We would just want to speak nicely. Kidichti, we find that Shlomo HaMelech uses the mouth as a way of talking about sex. So he says, Achla, she eats, and then she wipes her mouth and she says, I didn't do anything wrong. And obviously that's not talking about eating and it's not talking about her mouth. And therefore we use the same kind of euphemism. So she was talking. We don't mean talking, but we're saying it nicely. And according to Ze'iri, I understand, okay, that would explain the two cases in the Mishnah. One case is that she was alone with him, and we suspect that they had actually been lovers. And the other one is that she was pregnant, and therefore Rabbi Yoshua is saying that she's Asura, even though we don't have any basis of saying other than our sense that they have a very close relationship. That tells us that according to Rabbi Yoshua, she's Asura anyway. And the second case where she's pregnant tells us that Rabbi Gamliel holds that she's Muteret anyway, even though she actually did sleep with someone. Okay, that adds up. But according to Rav Asi, in both cases, we're talking about they were sleeping together. What is added by case number two if we already know what the witness is? Ra'ua Midaberet says, Ra'ua, we saw them actually having intercourse. What's the difference between that and being pregnant? Well, isn't it obvious? Well, the first case is, what is her status vis-a-vis the kahuna? And the second question is, what would be the status of a daughter if this pregnancy produces that daughter? Can that daughter marry a kohen? And that would be the question. It's two completely different issues. The woman herself has a cheskes kashrus, but the child doesn't have a cheskes kashrus. Well, now, isn't that a question later on? Says the Gemara, I mean, on Amud Beis, we're going to have a whole machlokas about, is the fact that she is muteret, does that mean that her daughter is muteret? Or no, her daughter would be asura because she lacks a chazaka. So, I mean, if you hold like the Mandi Omar that we're about to see, that Lamandi Omar, Ledivrei HaMakshir Ba, according to Rabbi Gamliel, who says she's kosher, so too is her daughter kosher. You could say that I need this one to tell me the Chiddush about the daughter. But what about according to Lamandi Omar, who says, no, actually, only she is kosher, not the daughter. So then, the second case is not referring to daughters. And when it says that she's pregnant, it just means she definitely had relations with him. That's all that it means. Doesn't mean she delivered a child or anything. It might even just be another level of euphemism, right? So, okay, so we're talking about, you know, for all intents and purposes, she might as well be pregnant. I mean, okay, so but what are you going to say? Why are there two cases? Well, obviously, Rav Asi holds, since he says that the two cases would be both of them where we know for a fact that they'd slept together, and the second case is only there to tell me what the din is of the child, he obviously holds like the Mandi Omer who says that Rebbe Gamliel and Rebbe Lozer are makshir not only but they're also makshir bibita. Amale Rav Papa Abaye, I don't understand Ze'iri. According to Ze'iri, he says bidaberet means that she was alone with him. And even then, Rabbi Yoshua says, well, we assume the worst, and she's been sleeping with someone who potzels her. I don't understand. She's not married, right? And Rav said that when an unmarried girl is alone with a guy, what we will do is we'll punish them, so we'll beat them up, midrabana. We'll give them malchus midrabana, because they were over on yichud. But ein osrina la yichud was certainly not going to claim that a woman is asura to her husband. We don't take a yichud as being the equivalent of having slept with a guy. But so then what is exactly Ze'iri? What does he hold? I mean, if he holds that, no, it's the same thing if we saw them alone, so then she's asura. Are we saying that we have to understand that Rav is against Rabbi Yoshua? Because according to Ze'iri, Rabbi Yoshua actually said that it passels. And Rav says it doesn't passel. No. Rabbi Yoshua was talking about, is she kosher for a Kohen? Things are different when you're talking about a Kohen. The Rabbanan made here, that's why we've got Barnea back in here. He wants to make sure. Don't think it's about drink and dig. It's really about the chumras for the kahuna. When it comes to marrying a Kohen, we have higher standards. Sally, Charlie, we don't take tuna like you. And so the same thing is true over here. You want to marry a Kohen, then you cannot have a woman who's been alone with a guy. And that's Ma'ala Asuba Yuchasin. For the Kohanim, we make a Ma'ala, and she's a Surah. But in a Chinami, Rav wasn't talking about Rav. It's talking about for non-Kohanim. Neitve. Now, a problem with Rabbas. In a Braita, it says that if we see her going alone with a guy into Seder, into a place which is, who knows what happens, or we see them going into a churva. Now, a churva is different than a mokum seser. Why? Because a churva is actually the meaning of that good old song, Mrs. Robinson, for all of you older people. Everybody knows what she's tippy-toeing down there for. In other words, a churva is basically only used by people who want to sleep together. You don't normally go into a churva if all you're interested in is having a walk going down Lover's Lane, which may be a mokum seser. So if I'm adding the churva, so then I'm telling you, even though we know that, or we can assume that they only went there to actually sleep together, and we say to her, so tell us, what's this guy like? Oh, come on, you know this guy, it's what all the girls always say. He's my cousin. I was just with my cousin, a very nice guy. Kohenu, Ben Achiabu, who is my uncle's son. So Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer Omrim, she's them in it. And Rabbi Yoshua gives his standard answer, Lo mi pia anu chayin, el arezu becheskat be'ulala netino lamamzer, acheta vira ya lidvorea. Now we're looking to see things from the point of view of the Rebbe over here. The Rebbe is obviously looking up into the ceiling, and he's thinking, does this give us a theory of mind? Not really. When you see his face, we have much more of a theory of Rebbe's mind. So, thank you, that's much better. So, the question over here is, according to Ze'iri, Ze'iri says, midaberet means just being alone. So the same thing in the Braisa. The Braisa has two different cases. Either she goes into Seser, meaning they were just alone, or she goes into a churva, which is the equivalent of going into a whorehouse, as far as we're concerned. And Rav Asi, however, has got a problem. Because according to Rav Asi, being alone is never meaningful. The only issue is nimala. So then why do I have two cases in over here? Even if you're ready to say that the first case of Seser means Seser in a churva of some kind, I mean, why do we need two different cases? Nah, you misunderstand. It's all one case. It means we see her going into a seser, meaning what kind of seser? The seser of a churva. Ah, come on, man. I mean, did you ever hear of the word or? Or, thank you. It says over here, we see her going into a seser or a churva. Now, what do you mean? Seser of a churva. No, we don't mean literally it means one case. We mean seser churva. In other words, one is relative to the other one, only a seser, but it's a super seser. One is the churva in a field, and one is the churva in a city. So chada churva de masa, v'chada churva de dabra. Why is there a difference? Aren't both of them for purposes of sleeping together? They are. But the situation is very different. Because let's say the Brisa spoke about only a case of a churva in a city, and we're assuming that most of the city is Jewish. It's the shtetl. It's a churva of the shtetl. Nu. So in the shtetl, of course, Rabbi Gamliel says she's still kosher for the kahuna, because, I mean, who goes to the churva in a shtetl? Ah, alle gute, feine Yidden, they're the ones that are going to the churva. And because of that, we can assume that rover ksherim etzla. So because of that, she's okay. But in a churva de dabra, where over there, you could have anybody, some guys going along. This, I mean, you have to go according to the rove of the world. The rove of the world, most people are puzzle, obviously. So she goes to a churva in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it could be some Ruski is over there, and he's a soldier, and maybe he was the one that was sleeping with her. And therefore, maybe they would have agreed to Rabbi Yoshua. And in the other case, let's say, would only tell us the churva out in the field, I would have said, well, of course, that explains why Rabbi Yeshua says that she's puzzle. But in the event that she was in town, maybe it would be made that if most people are kosher, it's kosher. So therefore, I need both cases. That doesn't bother me. But I do...
She'll be digging. They might find us when she goes to the churva. In the
what?
Redigging a churva in the field.
Okay, very good. If you find anybody there, make sure you paskin like Rabbi Yeshua. Now, Meitve, we have another problem here from a different brisa, which goes like this. Now, the Gemara is cutting into the middle of a brisa over here. So we're going to cut into the words that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, the closing words are, Zoe duche shak sheirala. Well, we believe women in this case. And what's important to us is this continuation. So Rabbi Yeshua says, absolutely not. Eina nemenet. And here we become privy to discussion between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Gamliel. So Rabbi Yeshua says to Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Gamliel, now listen, you guys admit, because this is a mission later on, you guys both admit that in the event that she was captured by Goyim, she was kidnapped, and we have witnesses that she was kidnapped, okay? Yesh la'idim shenishbet. She claims nobody slept with me. You agree that she's not believed and that we have to assume that she had slept with these goyim over here and that she's puzzle for a coin. Are you not? Omrulo said they to Rabbi Yeshua, absolutely. Aval, we certainly do. Well, says Rabbi Yeshua, so what the heck is the difference? Ma efresh ben zo lezo. What's the difference between a woman who was alone and you about the case where she was with these kidnappers? Said they to him, what do you mean, what's the difference? There's an enormous difference. Lezo yesh edim. It basically, when a woman is with kidnappers, then we have the best edus that she was raped. That's called anan sahadi. We are witnesses. What are you trying to tell me? That all of these goyim that have this woman, they didn't rape her. Bull. So that's the best aid as far as I'm concerned. Masha Enkin, in this case, where she was, she was only midaberet. Aha. So we don't have witnesses. So Rabbi Yeshua said, what do you mean? We have wonderful witnesses. Her tummy is so big that she can barely eat a sandwich without getting her tummy into her mouth. Well, where the heck did that tummy come from? To me, I think that's even better witnesses that this was no virgin pregnancy, let me tell you that. So how come you're talking about having Adam or not having Adam? So they said to him, well, the next two lines are total non sequiturs. You're not meant to understand them. And we're going to get back to understanding them in a moment. So they said to Rabbi Yeshua, well, most goyim are prutzim ba'arayot. So he said to them, well, in apotropis larayas, there's no such thing as having someone guaranteeing a get sleeping together when you're alone. Anyway, none of that makes sense. Now, let's just get back to the Braita, and then we'll make sense of it. So the Braita finishes with the problem that we have. So, okay, when do we say that the woman is believed? That's only be'edut isha begufa. That's where the woman is talking about herself. But the edus isha bebita, if the woman is talking about her daughter, everybody agrees that the child is a shtuki. So before we ask the obvious question on Reb Asi, which is kind of come about in this moment, we need to understand what was the conversation in the Braita, the part that made no sense. Micah Armelo, what was Reb Yeshua saying to them? And what were they answering him? Well, this is what they were saying. You gave us a very nice answer about the case of the pregnant woman, and you said, well, that's also witnesses. But what are you going to answer us about the case of the Midaberet, where we have no reason to believe that she had actual relations with him? So he said to them, it's exactly the same. Amar lahem, Midaberet is the case of a Shvuya. By the Shvuya, we don't have any witnesses of what happened to her. And by the Midaberet, we don't have any witnesses. And yet you agree to me that the Shvuya is a Surah. And answered Rabbi Gamliel, well, obviously, a shvuya is because she's shvuya by goyim, and most goyim are prutzim ba'arayot, and therefore we have to assume that they raped her. The first thing they would do if they get their hands on a woman is they would rape her. What's going to stop them? Amar lahem, so Rabbi Yoshua said to them, and this guy that was speaking to her, that you say, well, why should we think that they were only talking? As far as I'm concerned, it's the same exact situation. Because kivan di stater, once people are alone, ain apotropos la'arayos, there's nobody is going to stop them from sex. That's the natural end of these types of relations. But anyway, we see clearly that they themselves explain that they're talking about two different cases. One is the case of Midaberet, and they say to Rabbi, well, what are you going to tell us about Midaberet? And the other one is the case of Meuberet. Whereas according to Reb Asi, both cases were where we knew 100% that they had had relations. One because she's pregnant, and the other because we have witnesses. And here, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Gamliel are saying themselves that they're two different cases. Oh, man, forget it. Tiyufta to Reb Asi, tiyufta, that totally, totally blows away what it was that Reb Asi was saying. So now we understand that there is really only a case where we know that they had relations. Couldn't we just give a simple answer, asks the Gemara? Isn't there an obvious difference between the Shvuya and the one who was talking? I mean, in the case of the Shvuya, everyone that would have had any relations with her would have passed her because they're goyim. Mashenkin, in the case of a woman who's just talking to somebody, most of the people are kosher people. So why in the world isn't there that difference? And how could Rabbi Yoshua even say that they're the same? They're totally different. And why would Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer have to agree, well, yeah, you're right about the case where she's pregnant, that he's not right? Unless this proves Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi's contention. Namely, the Om Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, that if you hold, like Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer, that we're machshir even in a case where most of the people are puzzled, for that matter, even in a case where everyone will be puzzled. And the Divrei HaPosel, if you say you're puzzled even Berov Ksheirim. And therefore, neither Rabbi Yeshua nor Rabbi Gamliel are bringing up the elements of the Rov, because basically, it is irrelevant. Now, tomorrow, we're going to get to the other issue, which is, so does that mean that the case of where she was pregnant is, by definition, are we talking about the status of the child as opposed to her own status? That we touched on it a moment ago, L'divrei ha-machshir ba, is it machshir bebita or not? Tomorrow, we'll go into the details of whether the chazaka, the cheskas ha'em, is Mahanya for the bat or not. So you remember that we had two cases in the Mishnah, in the latest Mishnah, and one of the cases was where we were asking about the woman herself, apparently. We were saying, like, okay, who's this guy? Maybe the fact that you were, we don't know, it doesn't mean you were alone with him, or doesn't mean you were actually seen sleeping with him. This was a machlokas. Remember, we had two approaches. It's what Midaberet means. And then the second case was a case where we said she was pregnant, which if you learn that the first case is a reference to actual witnesses that they were sleeping together, then there's really no difference between the first case and the second case on the surface. And as we said, if you hold that, then the obvious solution would be to say that the second case where she's pregnant, the question revolves around the child. So what we're asking her there is, what will be the status of the child with whom you're pregnant? But as we said, that's not necessarily the only way to understand the Mishnah. So it could be that we're just talking about pregnancy sort of as another euphemism. And therefore, today we get into the question about whether the two issues are necessarily interrelated. So we got up to Misayele Rabbi Yoshua. We got up to Omar Rabbi Yochanan. Sorry. So this is about one third of the way up from the bottom. Omar Rabbi Yochanan. To talk about that question, you should know l'divrei ha-machshir ba, machshir bibita. Look, the machlokas over here in the Mishnah is between Rebbe Gamliel and Rebbe Eliezer on the one hand, who say that she's kosher. But you should know that they mean that if she gives birth to a daughter, that this daughter is also kosher. And according to Rabbi Yoshua, if she is posel, her daughter is also posel. Now, of course, the psul is not necessarily the same basis. I mean, the divrei machshir ba, the reason that we're machshir ba is because we're saying that the person who sleeps with her didn't pasul her for the kahuna. But as far as the psul of bita is concerned, the question of bita would have to be somebody who's not necessarily pasul for the kahuna, would have to be somebody who actually would create a psul on the daughter. But once we're saying that the person who slept with her is an Adam who's kosher, even Lagabi passing her from the kahuna, so then, of course, if that's the case, then her daughter is also possible, is also kosher. Mashenkin Rebbe Lazar says, not necessarily. L'divrei machshirba, the one who says that she's kosher, is still mole that when it comes to the child is possible. Why? Oh, my Rabbi, my time in the Rebbe Lazar, why would it be that the child would be puzzled despite the fact that the mother has been defined as kosher? Now, obviously, we have two different issues over here because, I mean, the mother has to do with whether she slept with someone who was asura to her. And the daughter is the question of whether the father is be'etzim a puzzle, like in a scene or a mamzer and so on. So what Rebbe Lazar is saying actually makes sense because Bishlam Ihi eat la chazaka the kashrut. Look, the mother we know was up until this time a completely kosher Jewish woman who could get married to a kohen. Everything's beseder. Why would we change that status based on a suspicion that we are raising? The chazaka is always a solution to suspicions. Maksha Inkin, when the daughter comes to marry, we tell her, I don't know, who are you exactly? Who is your father? So when she says, well, we already know who my father was. My mother said he's a great guy and, you know, he's a Kohen and everything. And you said you believed her. We believed her. We believed her in terms of herself. We believed her not to change her status. But you don't have any presumptive status at all. You were just born. Now we got to decide who got you your mother pregnant. I have no idea vis-a-vis you who got your mother pregnant. So then when she says, well, I mean, how can you separate between those issues? So our answer to her will be, little girl, when you learn about how to think, you can ask that question. A chazaka doesn't work by telling us the facts, obviously. We have no idea who impregnated your mother. But the point is that we left her on her chazaka. But how does that have anything to do with who your father was? It certainly doesn't tell us the reality. It just tells us the din. Your din, because we have a suffix and we have no chazaka, your din will be that you remain a suffix ister. And therefore you can't get married without it being to someone that is not sensitive to psul kahal. So it's the difference is clear. Bishlama ihi itla chazaka de kashrut. Mami, was kshera from when she was born, and now you're trying to change it. But you, bita, let lechazaka de kashrut. The moment you were born, we had no idea who you were. When your mother was pregnant with you, we had no idea who you were. Masha Einkein, obviously, the idea of that Alibi de Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, but divrei ha-makshir bo ha-makshir bibita, this is a profound machlokas that we have about the nature of chazaka always. Is chazaka merely a presumptive din, which has nothing to do with our determination of our assumptions of reality? All we're saying is that she was kosher, she remains kosher. We're not saying when somebody says, well, didn't she sleep with somebody? Do you know who he is? We're saying we couldn't care less. We have a chazaka and we have no positive reason to change the chazaka. No, that's not what we say according to the way Rabbi Yochanan understands it. According to Rabbi Yochanan, we say, look, the fact that the din is mechayev of us to continue assuming that she is kshera as she was a minute before this happened, then we'll have to say that our relationship to what happened is that the guy that was sleeping with her must have been kosher for her and didn't passel her the kahuna. In which case, when the child ends up now being questioning, what am I? We'll say, well, we know what you are because we already said your mother is someone that is completely okay, right? So that's the question. How exactly does a chazaka work? And that's what we were really looking for. So, Eisei Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yochanan. So now the question is, we have a brayta. Remember the brayta that we said before. So the brayta goes on and says, "Bameh dvarim amurim." So where is all of this? Be'edut isha begufa, aval edut isha vebita divrei hakol avlat shtuki. We only will believe that this woman is kosher about what she says for herself. But as far as her testimony about her own daughter, we don't believe her. Everybody agrees that the child is a shtuki. I mean, the last I heard, the word shtuki is a very nasty way of saying she's puzzle. Because remember, the way we understand shtuki is that since we have no idea who daddy is, and this kid is pretty desperate to find the daddy, and so she's running over to everybody that comes into the house. "Oh, are you my daddy?" "Shh," says the mother, right? So basically, the idea is that she's puzzle. So doesn't it say her beferish that she's puzzle? "No," says Rabbi Yochanan. "She's a shtuki, but she's kosher." "What?" says Rabbi Elazar. "What are you talking about? There's no such thing as that. How could a shtuki be kosher for marrying a kohen? I don't understand." Says Rabbi Yochanan, "My gosh, you just made a seam on your vamas 2 days ago, and you don't remember your vamas. What's with you, man?" Kiddush Shmuel, remember we had Shmuel saying over there that if you've got 10 Kohanim that are standing together having a drink, one of them says, "Could you excuse me for a moment," goes into a bathroom and gets a woman pregnant and comes back and continues with this drink like nothing happened, you know, and then she has this child who said, we don't know which Kohen it was, one of those Kohanim, but they were all Kohanim. This was an official Kohen bar. You couldn't even get in if you weren't a Kohen. You had to show it to that Kohen. "You, Barnea, you got your Tudat Kohen. I'm not accusing you of being in that bar. I was just wondering if you could show us Tudat Kohen officially."
"I can show the five coins. They just got a bit in the bag."
There we go. That's pretty good. Mazel tov. So the idea over there was, remember that Shmuel had this incredible insight that if you don't know who daddy is, even though you know every Kohen who came into that bar was a bona fide Kohen with a Tu'udah and so on, then that child is called a shtuki. Now, what in the world do you mean shtuki? I mean, we know that you couldn't have a better yichus than this child. So my shtuki, I mean, what do you mean? That the child doesn't get to inherit his father? I mean, obviously, we don't know who his father is. How could we possibly give him the Yerusha of his father? There is no father, as far as we know. How could we give him? Therefore, what did Shmuel mean? That mashtikino to midinei kuna. That means we don't allow him to eat truma. We don't allow him to work in the Beit HaMikdash. And as far as we're concerned, he's not a kosher kohen. Why is that? This is this week's parsha. Vaitalo lezaro acharav brit kunat olam. So why does it specify that it has to be zaro acharav? Because that's the point. Misha zaro miuchas acharav. Isn't that the whole point of Pinchas? That it's all about the assertion of Yichus, that we know who is who. And that was the godless of Yisrael. And that's what he was trying to preserve. And that's the whole point. Kahuna, without being able to pinpoint who the father is. Forget about the fact that I know that the father is kosher. That's not the only issue that is Yichus. The idea of Yichus, as we learned in Yevamos, and we spoke about on Shavuot, well, what's it? Dichrei Yud Ches B'Tamuz was that the point is it's Omer Dover B'Shem Omerai. And that means DNA also has to be Omer Dover B'Shem Omerai. Now you're coming along and you're saying, somebody said, don't tell me somebody said, somebody impregnated, don't tell me somebody impregnated. Who? That's the point. And therefore, vis-a-vis the kahuna, Shtuki, amazing, amazing insight into the nature of the interrelationship of Dibur. It's literally Omer Dover B'Shem Omer. It's amazing the depth of the connection. And therefore, he's not kosher. Yotze Zesha Ein Zaro Miyuchas Acharav. So when we're saying that the mother's is the child is a Shtuki, it's not talking about a case where we don't know at all about the man. It's talking about this case. Everyone that we were wondering about was a Kohen. So then we asked her, so who's the father? So that's the question. Is she believed, Lagabi, who the father is? No, because the Vlad is a Shtuki. I don't believe her that it's this particular person, because that's not Omer Dover, but Shem Omer. That's the issue.